Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Recently, Wyoming Public Radio won 6 regional Edward R. Murrow Awards for Best Hard News, Investigative, and Sports Story. We also won for the Best Use of Sound, Best Continuing Coverage, and Best Documentary. Today, we thought we'd play you some of those pieces. One story looks at the lack of police training when it comes to sexual assault.
From what we hear from survivors, it's very hit or miss out there across the state.
We'll also hear about challenges surrounding long-term care and finding work if you're a laid-off minor. We'll also look at an extreme sport you may not have heard of.
And that's the World Championship Indian Relay Races.
And what climate change does to ice fishing. Kick back and join us for the next hour. It's Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to the Murrow Award-winning edition of Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Sexual assault is a crime that's still chronically underreported across the nation. Victims say they're hesitant to report rape and sexual abuse because they're worried they won't be believed. In response, some law enforcement agencies in Wyoming see training as a way to gain victims' trust. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Tennessee Watson reports, that's not a statewide priority.
Tara Muir says Wyoming is a crapshoot for victims of sexual assault.
Definitely from what we hear from survivors, it's very hit or miss out there across the state.
Muir is the policy director at the Wyoming Coalition Against Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
Even within a county, our advocates might talk about, wow, we sure hope Officer A is the one who comes out on this call and not Officer B, which is heartbreaking.
Muir says some survivors would rather forego the criminal justice system than risk an interaction with an officer who makes them feel like the assault was their fault. Laramie's police chief, Dale Stalder, agrees.
We have to do a better job making sure that victim felt a sense of justice throughout and felt supported. So then that victim goes and tells other people that have been victimized by that crime, hey, it's okay to report.
Not every report will end in prosecution, but Stalder wants victims to feel like they've been heard and that their case has been thoroughly investigated. That starts with an understanding that trauma can alter a victim's ability to recount what happened.
If you report to me that stuff was stolen out of your car, you don't have all those emotions. You've been traumatized to a certain degree, but you don't have all the emotions that you have if you got raped. And in that trauma, your brain does all kinds of different stuff, and it confuses and complicates your ability to then tell the story.
Stalder says training on the impacts of trauma helps officers better understand what the victim is experiencing. But he wants to be clear that successful prosecution isn't contingent on these techniques.
Trauma-informed capability may give you some better tools, but investigating a rape is no different than investigating a homicide or a burglary or anything else from a putting together the evidence perspective. It's just providing extra tools to do a better job in that victim-centered way. I think it's valuable.
It's valuable enough that Stalder decided to train his entire department, including patrol officers. The thinking is it's less of a crapshoot for victims if every officer is trained. But he says that's not happening across the entire state.
Wyoming is very much controlled at the local level.
Once peace officers graduate from the Law Enforcement Academy, they're required to do 40 hours of additional training every 2 years. But the focus of that training is left up to local agencies. The Peace Officers Standards and Training Commission, or POST, logs officers' training hours. Gangs 1, defensive driving, active shooter, firearms qualification, drug interdiction, radar, street survival seminar. I sorted through the last 10 years of that data. Out of over 180,000 course entries, I found that around 1% of that training focused on sexual assault. And the amount of training varies all across the state. Step out of the city of Laramie into Albany County, and about half of the sheriff's office is trained. I asked Albany County Sheriff Dave O'Malley why, when we know sexual assault is so pervasive and so damaging, does he not require all of his officers to have additional training?
You know, that's really a good question, because it's something that we strive to always move forward.
He says increasing the amount of training is a goal, but Albany County has limited resources.
Our training budget is $22,000 a year, and that's for 46 people. And we've been pretty lucky at being able to maintain that budget, even though it's about $8,000 less than it was 10 years ago.
Sending officers out of state for training can cost thousands of dollars. There's flights, hotels, course fees, and then there's the overtime pay for whoever covers the shifts while officers are gone. Larger agencies like the Laramie PD might have an easier time moving folks around to fill shifts, but that's harder for the state's smaller agencies, such as the Sheriff's Department, with fewer people on staff.
If we can get it localized, if we can bring it here, we get more bang for our buck and we can get more people involved.
Police Chief Dale Stalder says legislation that passed during the 2018 session has started to divert funds from speeding fines to be used for more training. He's hopeful that some of that money could be used to bring sexual violence training to more remote parts of the state. But just because the money is there doesn't mean that there'll be interest.
You have to sell it to your people, because I got guys that have been investigating crimes for a long time, and now I'm telling them, you know, investigate it like this. And they can be resistant.
Stalder says pressure from the community helps, like when women in Casper came forward several years ago because they felt reports of sexual violence were being brushed off.
And the police department up there reacted to that perception by really putting in some strong training and policy protocols for investigation of sexual assault.
The Post data shows that in 2018, over 50 officers with the Casper Police Department were trained on the trauma-informed approach. Stalder says similar change can happen across Wyoming if everyone speaks up in their community. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Tennessee Watson.
When the coal company Black Jewel filed for bankruptcy, the move put more than 1,500 miners out of a job in Wyoming and across Appalachia. Many struggled to find work, and it wasn't just about the job market. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim won for best continuing coverage, and this was one of those stories.
Quit!
Darlene Ray calms down her three dogs outside Gillette. Until 2 months ago, Ray worked in Black Jewel's warehouse, writing invoices, receiving freight. But since the coal company's abrupt bankruptcy, she's been stuck looking for work.
Every day, you keep waiting and wondering if somebody's going to call you, you know, and there's nothing.
Ray slaps down a sheet of paper listing all the places she's applied for jobs.
Peabody Energy, Cloud Peak, Campbell County Hospital, Walmart, Pegasus.
Next to many is the word rejection. Ray has a medically retired husband and a mortgage. Worst comes to worst, she'll have to sell the house and move. A tough option with grandkids nearby. She's struggling despite what she's hearing, that the job market in Gillette is strong. The local workforce center says companies are underemployed, unlike the downturn in 2015 and 2016. Even Black Jewel had openings until its bankruptcy July 1st. That day, when the company went under, it furloughed about 600 employees. 2 months later, only a quarter of those workers are back to work, plus a small skeleton crew, according to local management. With a strong job market, Ray has an idea why people like herself are struggling to find work. It's about job skills.
If you know how to drive a haul truck, can run a shovel, you know, an electrician, a mechanic, a welder, yeah, the mines are picking you up left and right.
Rick Mansheim with the Gillette Workforce Center agrees. Mines are looking for skilled positions, but he says that's not the only reason so many locals aren't back to work. Most of those reasons don't have to do with the job market itself.
I think most of them are just waiting to see what happens.
In other words, hoping to get their old job back. At the start of Black Jewel's bankruptcy, warehouse worker Melissa Peterson-Warden fell into that category. We're talking in her office, as she calls it, a restaurant in downtown Gillette.
The one thing I've always heard is a mine will never close. They will never close a mine. And in one day, they close two.
But still, she was sure Eagle Butte and Bel Air would reopen and wanted to wait.
I wanted to be a part of that group that brought the mines back and came up from this unheard of thing that we had just gone through.
Being a part of that group meant she would get her old job back and restore these historic mines. Her plan, her hope, affected her job search.
I didn't even make it into the door of the job fair because my heart wasn't in it.
But now, after over 2 months of the mines staying closed, Peterson Warden's attitude has shifted. In fact, she would no longer work at Black Jewel, especially after hearing the potential buyers Contura do not plan to keep the mines open long term. But she still wants to get back in her field. That's where her focus is.
For me to accept a job that's either not in my field or not at the pay rate I want, that would be a temporary job to me. You know, I still want to be in my field. I still want to be associated with coal mining. There's definitely a standard of living that I would like to maintain.
Gillette Workforce Center's Manchime says that's another common reason many are still out of work. The urge to continue that specific lifestyle of a miner, with good pay and long hours. However, Manchime says those jobs are harder to come by. So, former Black Jewel workers have moved elsewhere. South Carolina, Utah, Nevada, Arizona, all to find better, higher-paying jobs.
Hey, how's it going, man?
Hey, man,
Dan Zarecki is moving to Montana for that reason.
I have had the option, several options, to take a big pay cut and work here in town. I want that 401k, I want that pension, I want whatever comes with it. I feel like my family deserves that.
Zarecki has a family and a baby due in October. His family wants him to stay in town. He'd prefer it too. But he says it's a dog-eat-dog world. You have to make sacrifices to get what you want.
It's only 2.5 hours away. I'll be able to come here on my days off. And it's worth it.
Workforce Center's Manchime says the job-seeking traffic has slowed down since the bankruptcy. But a new wave is coming in. People who've waited for Black Jewel to reopen are now ready to move on. He says a furloughed worker came in today and was ready to finally start a job search. It's been over 2 months now, and technically, Black Jewel has still not laid anyone off. But in Gillette, it sure feels that way. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
When we come back, we will discover a rodeo event you may have never heard of, plus ice fishing in the era of climate change. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. Today, we are replaying some of our regional Murrow Award-winning stories. For 89 years, the Sheridan Wyo Rodeo has drawn big crowds to the city's fairgrounds. But one exciting event in particular is known to keep them coming back every year. Best Sports Story Award winner Catherine Wheeler reports on what many say is North America's most extreme sport.
Now, how many of you enjoyed the Indian relay?
The Sheridan Wyo Rodeo dates all the way back to 1931. And Sheridan County Commissioner and Rodeo Board Member Emeritus Tom Ringley says locals got the idea during the years of the Great Depression.
They wanted some activity for the town because it was just dead as a doornail.
But its most famous event has only been around for 23 years.
We've got an event which is not a sanctioned PRCA event, but is sanctioned by the Sheridan Wyo Rodeo. And that's the World Championship Indian Relay Races.
Sean Realbird is the Indian Events Coordinator for the rodeo. He says the sport originates with Plains Native American tribes stealing horses when they were at war with each other.
When they steal these horses, the horse that they rode would be played out, and they would jump on another horse. And they would do that all the way back home. And so that's where the Indian Relay started.
Realbird says they brought this tradition to reservations, and competitors raced around on an oval. In the 1990s, Sheridan Rodeo officials asked Realbird if there were some Native American events that could make their rodeo more exciting because attendance was going down.
Because if they didn't bring back the Native events, there was a possibility that they would have to cancel it because of the low fan base.
And Realbird says the Indian relay races caught on quickly.
There they go! In the middle of the
track. A race has a lot of moving parts. There are teams of four people, a rider and three others that control and stop the horses. and the rider starts by jumping onto the horse and rides bareback. After each lap, riders have to jump off the moving horse and jump onto a new one for a total of 3 laps. This can lead to a lot of chaos.
The wrecks and the excitement all happen when you're switching horses, because the other horse from another team could run into you, you could run into another team, you could fall off your horse, and they don't have no saddle, and they're riding bareback, and they're riding full speed.
They just cost themselves a chance to win the title. Will, what do you think about that?
Reelbird says not only is the race the most exciting sport in America, but it's also a way to preserve Native American culture and traditions.
Many, many years, it was not good to be an American Indian. But today, with organizations like the Professional Cowboys Association supporting Indian Relay, that we can bring this Native culture to the forefront. We can bring it and display it for all the world to see.
Reelbird even made a rule that riders have to wear traditional dress, and riders paint themselves and their horses with traditional designs.
They take great pride in their teams. I didn't foresee that these team members would all be utilizing a uniform with Native designs on them. They would, even now, some of the teams would come out with moccasins, and some of the teams would even come out with war bonnets.
And of course they win prize money. Reelbird says the Indian relays go beyond just the Sheridan Rodeo. There's a circuit and competitions all over the country. Reelbird invites all tribal nations to compete in the Sheridan race. He says that most participants live on reservations and that the competitions have had a positive impact. Paul Nomi is a competitor for the Alligator Creek team that comes from the Crow Reservation. He says he loves the fast pace of the sport.
Yeah, that's it. Brings a lot of excitement too. A lot of competition and big crowds. I think this one's probably the most extreme sport.
Tom Ringley of the Rodeo Board says the Indian relays are a vital part of what makes the Sheridan Wyo Rodeo great.
It's become an integral part of the rodeo. I can't imagine not having it.
On Saturday, the Mountain Crow team that represents the Crow Nation took the top prize after 4 days of competition. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Catherine Wheeler in Sheridan.
And I'll tell you, that was outstanding.
The warming climate has some parts of the world tiptoeing on thin ice. And for ice fishermen, that's no metaphor. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards won for Best Use of Sound when she went out with some longtime Wyoming fishermen who gave her some tips on staying safe on the ice as temperatures heat up.
On a pond in a top secret spot on the Laramie Plains, I take my first steps out onto the ice behind fisherman Larry Foyanini. He tells me to walk right behind him. He points out some open water in the middle where a spring percolates, keeping it from freezing.
We don't want to be in this area at all down there.
Are you kind of looking at the color of the ice and seeing
stuff?
Well,
it's so clear you can see through it down here.
You can see how far down those bubbles are?
Yeah, you can see straight in. This is nice and clear. Yeah. But there's some big cracks here. That kind of freaks me out.
Oh, cracks are always there.
The cracks are
ice expands
here?
When it freezes. Water does, and it has to crack.
Foyanini starts drilling a hole with an auger in the ice to make sure it's thick enough to fish on. He sticks his boot down in the hole and feels the thickness with his toe. 4 inches is recommended, but Foyanini says this pond is a foot thick and we're safe to fish. His friend, Guy Scarpelli, drags a sled out with the fishing gear. Soon, we've got some balls of Velveeta cheese on hooks, and Foyanini sits in a chair twitching them to attract fish. While we wait, Scarpelli tells me about an accident he had out here a few years back.
Well, I was right over there, and I didn't realize I was getting closer to where the spring had been, and the ice wasn't very thick. The next thing I knew, I fell through, and the thing that saved me was having Larry with me.
Yeah.
We lost the auger and everything.
Really?
Whoop.
How did you get him out?
I just laid out, flattened myself out on the ice where I was really flat, so I was distributing the weight and inched over towards him, and it still took us about 5-10 minutes
to really
finally got a leg up where I could grab it.
Neither of these guys is new to the sport either. Scarpelli started fishing on Seminole Reservoir near Rollins when he was a little kid back in the 1950s. But he says the sport has changed since then.
It's a shorter season, yes. And ice fished on April 23rd and still had 16 inches of ice. But I've also seen it where, like last year, I didn't feel that we were safe enough to go out fishing.
Foyanini agrees. He grew up in Rock Springs and remembers getting on the ice in October. Now he says he's lucky if it's December. Meteorologist Sean Sublett worked on a report called On Thin Ice for the research group Climate Central. He says that's because fall is lasting longer than it once did.
We don't get the extreme cold as much as we used to.
Cheyenne used to feel the bite of 25 below pretty regularly, but Sublett says it hasn't dropped that low since 1990.
We're seeing a little bit of a delay in Arctic air kind of coming into the Rocky Mountains. I see delay in terms of, you know, some of these colder outbreaks would begin to settle in late October or November, and now they're waiting into later November or December.
Rocky Mountain winter is now as much as 3 degrees warmer than it was a century and a half ago. Nighttime, when ice forms fastest, has warmed up 5 degrees in that time. Sublett says some lakes that used to freeze, like around Salt Lake City, they just don't anymore. He says such trends make ice more dangerous to walk or drive a truck on for fishing.
With the ice not getting as thick, it's a little more risky. Unfortunately, you know, you fall through that ice and you're into that just hideously cold water, and, you know, hypothermia can set in a matter of minutes.
The Wyoming Game and Fish Department's Sarah DiRenzo has some advice for safer ice fishing. Look at the color.
Clear ice is much stronger than cloudy or white ice. Cloudy or white ice means that it's been frozen and then thawed and refrozen, and that can create some instability because of air bubbles or frozen snow. And so if you are fishing on white ice, we recommend double the thickness of 8 inches.
She says people should never try to ice fish alone and should make sure that they take some essential safety gear.
Ice picks, we recommend a life jacket in some cases, and definitely packing extra clothes and hot liquids in case there is an ice fishing accident.
She also says not to fish on places like streams or rivers with a current flowing underneath because that ice is even less stable. Meanwhile, out on the pond, a fishing pole goes crazy. Someone has nabbed our cheese. Foyanini lets me do the honors.
Okay, whoa. Lift him out.
Okay.
All the way out.
Whoa.
Oh, your first fish.
What do I do?
Just lay him on the ground.
Lay him on the ground?
That's a rainbow.
The ice might be getting less reliable, but the trout are still down there swimming. Scarpelli, for one, isn't giving up anytime soon.
Here, fishy, 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 fishy.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
Coming up next, we'll hear about challenges facing long-term care by yourself. It's an episode of our new podcast, The Modern West, that was honored for Best Documentary. It's a lighthearted look at a very serious issue. We'll provide you the entire podcast coming up next on Open Spaces.
From Wyoming Public Media and PRX, this is The Modern West, exploring the evolving identity of the American West. I'm Melody Edwards. You remember that old commercial, "I've fallen and I can't get up"? For some people, that's no joke, especially if you live by yourself. Say you do fall down, like, who's gonna call for help? How's anyone gonna even know?
And I know, like, things like life alerts, and they make people say, well, that's for old people. Well, but yeah. You need them.
Well, you're right on track with what I'm thinking. I'm thinking that isn't necessarily cool.
Sure.
That guy there who's so worried about how cool life alerts are? That's Bob Beck. He's only in his 50s, but he's already thinking about this stuff. He's one of these baby boomers we keep hearing about, the huge number of them who are getting older and who are really going to start stressing out our healthcare system any minute now, especially in the West, where the closest hospitals can be hours away. Well, a recent tragedy got Bob thinking about what the future might hold for him as he navigates the world of elder care by himself.
In November of 2016, my wife of 32 years was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer. She never smoked a day in her life. After 4 pain-filled months, she died in a Laramie hospital room with my hand on her heart. It was the worst day of my life. For the previous 4 months, I was the prime caregiver. Although my mom flew in to help over the last 6 weeks when it became difficult for Debbie to be on her own. Not only did I take on all the household tasks, I drove her on slick roads to the doctors in Wyoming and Colorado. I took notes on things they said and found I surprised her with information she either missed or tuned out due to her pain. I had other tasks too. The most terrifying was I had to mix medication into a feeding bag and then put it into her port. That's essentially a tube where liquid food and chemo drugs would enter her body. I had to inject the medication mix into the food bag. Any air bubbles or incorrect mixes or dosage could kill her. In fact, I even had to mix the food at the hospital since their insurance carrier wouldn't let the nurses do it. At some point in the first couple of days, I did something wrong and blood spurted out of her. We had to make an emergency call to someone to come to our home to stop the blood flow. I would also wake up nightly and massage her and apply ointment when she awoke screaming from pain. I had to calm her down when the insurance company was debating whether or not they'd approve medication to deal with things like blood clots. Actually, I'd been a caregiver before. I looked after her after 2 total hip surgeries. Once I had to make sure she was breathing while an overworked nurse got to her after addressing another woman first. She also had 2 knee reconstruction surgeries, and I was in charge of getting her bathed, to the restroom, up and down stairs, fed, and all the things that go with that. Before she died, she thanked me for taking care of her and apologized for abandoning me. And then she was gone. And for the first time since I was 23 years old, I lived alone. Now I'm 58, I have no kids, and no family members nearby. And at some point it occurred to me that if something similar happened to me, I had nobody who could take care of me. Also, since my wife's death, I've had other friends with health challenges. One had a heart attack, and another, 15 to 20 years younger than me, had a stroke. In both instances, their spouse either saved their life or prevented serious damage. So lately I've been thinking, well, maybe I need a girlfriend. But I'm finding they're hard to come by. Then I started worrying about what would happen to me if I had a stroke, or if I simply fell down a flight of stairs at home. Would my coworkers and staff figure I just took a couple of days off and forgot to tell them? Would they eventually find my devoured body by the door, eaten by my Labrador retrievers dying of hunger? And how would I handle a serious operation or an illness if I live on my own? Turns out, I'm not the only one thinking about these things. Among those is Stefan Johansson, who's the deputy director of the Wyoming Department of Health. That's because the department is the outfit who will likely end up paying for most people's long-term care, whether it's in a facility or at home. We sit down in a windowless conference room, ironically not unlike some doctor's offices I've been to talk about some of this. He says the number of people who need somewhere to live with access to healthcare providers is growing.
We started to see an uptick in the amount of individuals enrolling in our long-term care programs, and that's no surprise because the demographics of Wyoming are rapidly changing. We're one of the fastest aging states in the country, and so it started to become a concern because that creates budget pressure on the Department of Health because our Medicaid program finances quite a bit of long-term care.
Let me break down a couple of things for you. First of all, I found in my travels that few people know exactly what Medicaid is and does. The state and the federal government share the cost of Medicaid, and it mostly helps elderly adults and people with disabilities. It's the funding that allows someone to afford nursing home or home health care. As Johansson explains, the price tag is a smidge high.
For individuals that would finance that themselves, in Wyoming, the average cost of in-home care, home health care, is about $52,000 a year. And for a nursing home, if an individual was going to pay out of pocket for a nursing home bed, that ranges up to $88,000 a year.
After talking to him, I couldn't stop focusing on the cost for in-home health care. I have some savings and will have a pension, but $52,000 a year? Who the hell can afford that? Now, it's cheaper if I find a home health care provider who only checks in once a week or so, which is great, except even if I can afford one, home health care providers are hard to find. In fact, finding anyone to care for elderly in this state is a challenge. I know this guy named Eric Boley. He's the head of the Wyoming Hospital Association, but also works as a lobbyist for nursing homes and a variety of long-term care facilities and deals with those types of issues. I asked him if I might have issues finding a nurse or someone to check on me from time to time.
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge concern. Workforce in general in our state is very difficult, but when it comes to finding the right people to serve our elderly, we're really running into some shortages all across the state, but especially when it comes to nurses and certified nurse assistants.
And trust me, I've read enough stories about elder abuse or people stealing from older people to know that you really, really want the right people taking care of you. Boley says there is nursing home space available across the state, but many people will have to relocate. I might get to stay in my town, but let's face it, that's not where I want to end my life career. I once worked in a nursing home back in high school. Let's just say I'd prefer some other options. But the reason all my options might get tight is this. Wyoming, like everywhere else, is seeing growth in the 65 and older crowd. Between 2016 and 2017 alone, Wyoming's 65-plus population grew by 3.7%. That was the fastest increase in the nation. By 2055, Wyoming's 85 and older population is expected to grow by a mere 227%. That's a whole lot of geezers in need of services, so by the time I need something, things might be scarce. Of course, the elephant in the room is what happens if you live in one of the state's more rural communities. I live in a college town of some 30,000, so we have some services, even a cancer center. But I remember when my wife had cancer, there was a man who drove himself roughly 90 minutes for chemo and had to drive himself home. This was in the winter, on a lonely two-lane stretch of road that frequently closes, and it's a haven for whiteouts. Shoot, it could have been worse. He might have needed to drive 2 or 3 hours to Colorado. Look, we're tough stock here, but that seems a little extreme. Like someone ought to be helping that guy out. Stefan Johansson of the Wyoming Department of Health summed it up for me.
Not only is there very little long-term care service available in some of those places, but also what's often needed on the medical side is 30 minutes, an hour and a half away. These problems with long-term care are really indicative of health care in Wyoming in general and just exacerbated by some of the demographic challenges that we're seeing and the growth in that sector.
This sounds like a mess.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I don't know if I would describe it as a mess. It's more maybe the hopeless optimist in me as an opportunity. We've been talking with our legislative partners and with our other stakeholders in the state about things that we could do differently, and I think there's some good ideas out there. We've put some information in front of our stakeholders and friends on savings programs that the state could look at for preparing people more for long-term care costs.
He tells me about other ideas regarding new ways to use senior centers, and AARP Wyoming wants to use Medicaid dollars to help train and even pay people in the community to be caregivers. This has reduced costs in other states and again keeps more people at home. But if you're like me, a longtime legislative reporter, and you know how quickly lawmakers move on some of these topics, these things might not be in place in time for my old age. I wondered if I was the only one worried about this stuff. So I drove the 45 minutes to meet with Aaron LeBlanc, who is the retired and senior volunteer program director who works with the 55 and older population over the mountains from me in Cheyenne. For those of you who missed this on a state trivia test in grade school, Cheyenne is the state capital. At roughly 65,000 people, it's the largest city in the state. Anyway, LeBlanc is a newcomer to Wyoming and smiles as I sit down in her cramped office that's connected to a larger senior center. Lately, she's been working with a number of older citizens on signing up for Medicare and the Medicare Part D program. Medicare is the federal insurance program for people 65 and older, and Part D is the program seniors use to determine how much they need for their medications. The cost of drugs for seniors is a whole other podcast episode, since few people have saved enough money to grow old and deal with all these healthcare needs. Anyway, I asked her if she ever talks to people who are like me, who live alone and don't have anyone to look after them.
It does come up because a lot of them also want to know what kind of services are available to come into their homes. So many of them don't qualify income-wise for certain services. They make maybe just a little bit too much, but then they don't make enough to privately pay for someone to come in, and they don't want to consider long-term care. And I think, I have found in my work that doctors, our hospitals are very quick to say, let's talk about going into the nursing home. Well, there's a lot of other options besides that. And I think a lot of seniors are terrified, of course.
I'll tell you what my concern is. I live at home. I'm a widower. Well, I don't have kids, so I don't necessarily have anybody that might check on me every day. Now, I do go to work, but we have one of those jobs where you could just take the day off or go do whatever. I've got this fear something's going to happen to me, mm-hmm. and I'll be sitting there at home for 3 or 4 days until somebody thinks to check on me. That's my concern. Am I just crazy to be that worried about it?
No, because I have elderly parents as well. And so I think it's better to not be in emergency mode, I guess is what I'm trying to say. It's good to try to plan out. So it's whether that's a life alert or a lifeline to have one of those to make sure that, you know, if you were not feeling well and you just couldn't get out of the chair or get out of your bed or you've fallen, people say, well, I have my cell phone. Well, sometimes that's not always it. And I know like things like life alerts and they make people say, well, that's for old people. Well, but yeah. You need them.
Well, you're right on track with what I'm thinking. I'm thinking that isn't necessarily cool.
Sure. And they don't always look very cool either. They're kind of, bulky looking. But I think it's good to be prepared for what could happen.
I got to view a life alert up close at Point Frontier. It's a retirement facility in Cheyenne. This place is nothing like that nursing home where I worked in high school. I thought I was walking into a fairly decent hotel. It allows for independent assisted living with medical staff on hand. It's got a dining area, a game room with a pool table, and couches around a fireplace. The rooms are nice too. They are apartment size, and if you don't want to hit the dining room, you can cook in your own kitchen. The only thing that's different is that somebody regularly checks on the residents to make sure they're okay. I figured this might be an option I'd consider. seemed like it was working out pretty well for Claudette Mowry. She spent her life in Casper with her late husband. Like me, when he got sick, she became his caregiver. After he died, she faced some of the challenges I've worried about. She was alone in Casper while her kids were elsewhere. Claudette tried to maneuver on her own, but she ran into some mishaps.
Did you ever worry about your own personal safety at any point?
After I fell twice.
Tell me about that.
I just took a quick turn, caught my toe, and skied across the cement. The next time it was in the night, I got up and tripped on a rug and fell. I laid there and cried and said, "Self, you can either crawl over to where you can pull up on something, or you can just lay here and feel sorry for yourself."
And how did you get help?
I called my granddaughter, and she came. But I limped back to bed, and I laid there till morning. I just didn't want to bother anyone.
Were you hurt? Seriously?
I broke my wrist.
So yes would
yes.
be the answer.
Yes is the answer.
When you live in a place like Casper and a winter storm hits, you can literally be isolated. It actually took a serious fever and urging from her children to move to Cheyenne, where she has one of those bulky life alerts, and a community of outgoing people and family nearby. I was ready to make a reservation.
Are there openings right now? Can I slide in and be down the hall?
I can't recommend you. I'm a newcomer.
There's a lot of people that would not recommend me, so I don't blame you.
As great as this seems, I'm honestly not sure what I actually think of getting into one of these. Groups in the state are building more of these facilities all the time, but to access one, you need to live in one of the larger communities in the state, which might mean moving hours away from my community of friends. So once again, I was back to thinking it'd be better for me to figure out a way to live at home. I was just hoping I could still drive, because in my small town, there's a bus, but it doesn't come around very often. And check this out. It's also a battle in our biggest city, Cheyenne. Greta Morrow is a retired school teacher and has lived in Cheyenne for over 45 years with her husband in a large, comfortable home at the edge of Cheyenne. She looks fit and healthy after surviving a battle with cancer a few years back. She had the means to get specialized treatment in Houston, but during some volunteer work, she came across an issue that's become her focus. You see, a lot of single older people can't get to a doctor, not just a specialist, just a doctor across town. And that's because of a lack of transportation, especially for older people who need help getting in and out of their homes or the store. For roughly 3 years, she's been working on fixing this, and it's been tricky. As you might guess, there's liability and other issues. Morrow's main concern was that these homebound people were isolated, and she wanted to get them to places to hang out, get their hair done, that kind of thing. But then, while discussing her work with a doctor, she learned about a significant problem.
And she said, "Oh, I really hope you do that, because I have many patients that I don't see during the wintertime, during the cold weather. I see them when their families can get them here, which tends to be in the summertime in the nice weather. And then they don't have health care the rest of the time because they can't get out." And I think, my heavens, that's right there is an indication of a need. So, you know, I called a case manager here in Cheyenne at a major medical practice. And I said, "What do you think about this? Do you think we need to have a volunteer driver program in Cheyenne?" And she said, "Oh my heavens, every day of my job, transportation is the number one problem."
I started thinking what it would be like to be stuck at home without the ability to get to a doctor to address a flu, pneumonia, or something like that. Hopefully Greta can find a solution. I'm also hoping that state health officials and lawmakers might be able to find their own solutions. One idea that could get some traction would be using volunteers or part-timers who could be trained to help homebound people. They'd be paid using Medicaid dollars. Another would allow communities to get grants to develop creative ways to deal with long-term care issues. So, during a break in a recent meeting, I cornered the chairman of the House Health and Labor Committee, Sue Wilson of Cheyenne. I've had a lot of conversations with Representative Wilson over the years, and she's generally a lot of fun. She laughs when I asked if they've solved all the problems that might be facing current and future old-timers like yours truly. So, I repeat my story about falling and getting mauled by dogs, and she told me I don't need legislation. I need to make my home safer, and I need some friends.
It's so important to stay involved with, you know, religious groups or bowling groups or the coffee club at McDonald's in the morning or that kind of thing, so that when people notice if you don't show up, right? I mean, if nobody ever sees you for 2 weeks at a time anyway, you could be cold on the floor before anyone discovers you. So some of that responsibility we need to take on ourselves or make our lives more integrated with other people.
When I've shared this story with friends, they found her comments harsh. But you know what? I think she makes a point. My family lives far away, and I can assure you that my behavior over the years would likely keep them from having me move in with them or taking care of me in any way. So that's out. I don't have kids, but I do have some good friends. A couple of younger friends already do kind of look after me from time to time, including a nurse.
Hi, I'm Jamie. I am a nurse in the operating room, and I am also Bob's friend.
Okay, so Jamie, we had talked about this actually before I even started this story, this issue that I'm concerned about. Living alone, and actually you came up with a little bit of a solution here. What were you thinking?
Oh, yeah. So I thought that we should buy a house together, a big house, with an adequate room. So there's basically a nice apartment in the basement or a lower level, and you would get the main part of the house, and we would basically just share space. You know, obviously a big perk to us sharing a house is if you were to go out and hire a healthcare provider, that provider isn't going to be around. You set a schedule and they come in, they check on you, they make sure your meds are in order and whatnot. And then they might have an ancillary person, a CNA, also come in and help you with meals and bathing. But these are, everything's kind of at set specific times. And so somebody's not really with you. But, the perk to me living in the basement is, you know, I'm there all night, potentially. And I'm around and I'm there every day. So there is that aspect of the care that that potentially would be better and more effective.
You'd do like rounds, come up and see if I'm breathing?
Yeah, basically. Oh, my God, if it got to that point. You know, if it got to that point. If that's what it came down to.
There is one thing that scares the crap out of me, but we'll just not worry about bathing just yet. So
we'll cross that. Hopefully, not have to cross that bridge.
But, I'll try and die before we get to that point.
or I'll just hire a CNA.
There you go. While that's a lovely proposal, I'm not really that interested in imposing myself on my young friends. So hopefully the state will hurry up and invest in more long-term options to help more people either stay at home or live in community-assisted living facilities. In the meantime, I've thought about that life alert, but I have found a much cooler option. I recently purchased the brand new Apple Watch. Turns out it has a wide range of health options, including alerts for falling or if my heart skips a beat. I still might get ravaged by dogs, but at least I'll have a sweet watch.
That was Bob Beck. You know, I might need to actually go out and get my parents a couple of these stylish Apple Watches. They live in a small town that's a full hour's drive over treacherous mountain passes from the nearest hospital. My mom's been having some health problems, and I can tell you, Man, does her town have an amazing ambulance team. They have to. It's truly life or death. One time, they even flight for lifed her over 13,000-foot peaks to a heart hospital. Luckily, she had Medicare and supplemental insurance. Otherwise, that trip would have cost her about 75 grand. The long-term plan, though, is for my folks to eventually move to my small city. They already have bought a house next door. I suppose it won't be long before I'll be taking my turn as the caregiver. Join us for a lively conversation on social media. You can find us at Modern West Pod. I'm Melody Edwards. The show's story editor is Aaron Jones. Our digital producer is Anna Rader. And our executive producer is Micah Schweitzer. The theme song is by Screen Door Porch. The Modern West is a production of PRX and Wyoming Public Media.
Once again, for more stories from the Modern West, subscribe wherever you get your podcast or find it under the podcast tab at wyomingpublicmedia.org. A new mini-season begins in June. Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. Support this award-winning coverage with your pledge at wyomingpublicmedia.org. You can find all of our stories on that site or on our Facebook page. Next week, we will bring you a special program on women's suffrage. Join us then. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.